Hello and welcome. My name is Scott Winstead, president of FMI Consulting. I'm really excited to share my conversation with Mary Tyker with you. Mary is the president of Tyker, a fifth-generation industry-leading family business in the heavy civil construction and construction material space. Tyker was founded in 1887 and is the owner of the 8th California Contractor's License. Mary received both her undergraduate degree and her MBA from Harvard University. She is a former director of product strategy for one of Apple's divisions and a former management consultant with Bain & Company. In addition to her day job with Tyker, she's held a number of prominent leadership roles within the engineering and construction industry. She is the immediate past president of the Beavers, a heavy engineering and construction association that includes the who's who in the heavy civil space. Mary is the first ever woman to serve in this role. She has served as chair of the California State License Board, as a senior fellow with the American Leadership Forum, and as a board member for the California Building Industry Association and the AGC. In our conversation, we touch on a number of topics, but really zoom in on ways to attract and retain women in construction operations roles. Well, Mary, good morning. Thank you for being here and welcome to the show.
Good morning. It's a privilege.
Well, I'd love to just start off with just a quick thumbnail of Tyker.
So Tyker was founded in 1887 by my great-great-grandfather, who was a foreman for the guy who invented expansion joints. So Adolf had been working for him as a foreman and then hung out his shingle when the state capitol was built in California. So decided he knew how to do this stuff and built the sidewalks around the state capitol. We ultimately got state contractor's license number 8. So we've been in business in California for about 137 years now. So I've sometimes pointed out that we talk a lot about Adolf, but also his wife, Carrie, was part of the program. And she did the books at the kitchen table while he rode around in the carriage and checked on jobs. So pretty exciting that nowadays we can ride around in the carriage and check on jobs. But Tyker has been in the infrastructure business ever since. And so we started with those sidewalks I was mentioning. We've always built the infrastructure that California needs. And so we went from there to building roads. We had state highway contract number 3, back when the state thought all we would have to do for these horseless carriages was to connect all the county seats. So we started building roads and then went on when state started flooding, we started building levees. And then in the World War II, we started doing airfields. And then when the soldiers started coming home from war, we built subdivisions. So ever since about the 1950s, we've been heavily involved in subdivision infrastructure. That's probably about a third of our business. And then we have another third that's interesting site work. So we build a lot of schools. And back in the old days, we used to build malls, not much of those for a while, but warehouses and big site projects. And then we also have a significant amount of public work we do. So we've always done those roads and streets and levees and dams and that kind of good stuff. We added materials in the 1930s. And so we also have 2 of the 10 largest sand and gravel plants in the country, about 22 rock plants. And so we do construction materials as well. And then around 2015, we started doing energy infrastructure. And so going back to the point of what does the state need? And increasingly, what do the Western U.S. states need? We do gas distribution as well as power distribution for electrical. So a lot of different kinds of energy and utility work at this point. So the common theme is infrastructure. And the company is about 3 times bigger than it was when I became chief operating officer in 2013. And we're doing more and more kinds of infrastructure because there's more and more to do.
Wow. We could have an entire conversation about that history. So fascinating. It's funny you mentioned the 137 years in business. I mean, that's the definition of rarefied air. In one of our previous podcast episodes, we talked with the CEO that was in the process of transitioning from he founded the business to his second generation. And we talked about the concept of enduring organizations. And I think we've got a perfect example of what that looks like when you go 5 generations. There aren't many firms of any type that can say that.
Well, you know, it's interesting. We've actually been in the midst of, for the first time, documenting our sustainability program. And one of the things the consultant who's writing the report said is that there's only 2 companies they've talked to that are as top to bottom committed to all their values as we are. And she said the other one's over 100 years also. And it made me sort of think, I wonder to what degree the fact that we've changed the work we do a lot, but we've always had a very common value set of building trust and tradition, doing things right, that's lasted us a long time. And people that want to work that way want to work here. So it could be as simple as that or as complicated as that. My grandfather's direction in the 1950s was that we're going to operate within the law and if we can, make a profit. And it's funny because hopefully the law is table stakes nowadays. But in the 1950s, you think about, here's what we're going to do is do stuff right. So I think we've been fortunate to attract some fantastic people, which is the reason we've been here so long.
You kind of touched on the question I wanted to go to is just the company's evolution and what is it the, I guess if there's a through line on how you would trace back all the success over the years, and it sounds like just the concept of core values and remaining consistent in those over time.
So Tykert is a regional contractor, and one of the benefits is that we have a significant concentration of work in the Western U.S., and so people, most of our people sleep at home most nights. And we have the super strong value set of, as I mentioned, doing things right. So folks that want to build things, generate trust with their customers and their employees, and follow the traditions that we have, as well as come up with some continuous improvement on occasion, tend to also be people who like their families and they like sleeping at home most nights. And they may want to coach their kid's little league team, and they might want to go home and see their kid during the day. So our business lends itself to that and attracts the people that share our values. So I think it's kind of been synergistic over time that the values that we have has people that like to be in our region, and then we get to keep moving that way. So I think that's one of my centerpiece ideas at this point. You know, I give my ancestors some credit for all of the strategic decisions, such as buying materials at good points in our history. So having significant presence in materials as well as construction, I think has helped us stay steady throughout all these years, because materials in California is a lot more concentrated of an industry than construction, because unfortunately, sometimes in construction, we're competing with any Joe Potatoes who can get a license and a bond. But materials has, I think our most recent rock plant that we built from scratch took us 17 years to permit. So California is a non-trivial place to do aggregate production. So having both of those things going means that we have some portfolio that's always sustaining us. So I think some smart business decisions and some values that attract the people that we most appreciate, and then they stay here for their whole careers. We have all these people that have been here 20, 30, 40 years, kind of combines to make us stick around a while. So yeah, part of my job is don't screw up.
That's easy to say, hard to do. I am curious, are the other seven contractors that had licenses 1 through 7, are they still around?
Nope, we're the oldest active license in the state. And it's funny because they didn't start issuing licenses here until I think it was the late 1920s or early 1930s. We'd already been in business for almost 40 years when they started issuing licenses. So I sometimes wonder if my great grandfather had gotten up earlier, could we have got license number one? Like, was he just eighth in line? But it is pretty, it's a significant thing. There's only about, I think there's 3 contractors with licenses lower than 100. So it's a pretty great honor to have been here this long.
That's awesome. You talked about people and the value of having those folks be able to stay at home, see little kids and go to baseball games and whatnot. Continuing on that theme as it relates to people, you know, one of the things that's sort of been tortured over the last several years is just the industry's talent shortage. I mean, it's become a bit of a cliche to say that there is a talent shortage in the construction industry. We've started to call it just a characteristic of the industry because it's not a trend. I mean, you can go back, look at ENR and trade rag covers over the last 50 or 60 years, and it's always been a thing. So I'm curious about how you think about this from an industry perspective.
Well, there are several dimensions to the talent shortage that we're focused on. One is that we're certainly faced with an aging workforce. And so if you look at sort of the number of workers that are over 55 in our industry and see that in the course of the, let's see, I think it's in the course of the last 10 years, it's about doubled. So over 55 used to be around 11.5%, and it's now almost 23%. So you look at, there's a lot of folks who have a lot of expertise who are getting closer to the end of their careers. So we need to find more people coming into it that have the willingness and ability and creativity to take their places. We have some significant issues with diversity. And so Tykert's not really unique in the fact that in California, we have an outstanding component of a Hispanic workforce, but we're super underrepresented on other demographics. And so there's a lot of communities that aren't selecting construction, and we want them to choose our industry and certainly choose our company. And then the one that I've spent a ton of time on, because it almost seems like low-hanging fruit, and also because there's no one in a better position to do it than me, is that we also don't have a lot of women. So nationally, there's about 11% women in construction, and in operations, it's about 6%. So it's just, if you think about the fact that women represent about half the population, that's a big gap. And so there's a lot of people not choosing it. So when you look at why is that, and what are some ways that we can start attracting additional talent if we tap into some of these categories, part of it is making our company an attractive place to work. And part of it is trying to figure out how do we identify and demolish the barriers that are keeping people from wanting to choose it? Because it's pretty statistically significant how different those numbers are.
I'd love to kind of go a little bit deeper on the concept of barriers, you know, in your role, both inside the company as well as in the broader industry. You know, what do you see as some of those common barriers that, could be low-hanging fruit?
One of the barriers is having women actually feel like they belong here. There's an observation someone made, what a difference there is between feeling welcome and feeling like you belong. So welcome would be that you're a guest in my house and you're welcome. And belonging would be you live here. So trying to have women feel like they belong is a big deal in this industry. And there's one of the centerpiece challenges is that there's some dimension of critical mass that is hard to come up with. And so if you're the only woman on a crew or you're the only woman on a team, then you pretty much all the time are inventing for yourself. How is it that I fit in here and what am I supposed to be doing? And if you're actually got some company or some models or some people to share your experiences with, it becomes a less isolated experience. So just the simple fact of how comfortable do you feel at work and does this feel like a place that you should be, I think has something to do with finding ways to have numbers come together. So at Tykert, I started a women in operations group about 10 years ago for the simple fact that I looked around and we didn't really have very many because I had started out feeling like I was raised thinking that women can do anything men can do. My dad was super encouraging that way. So I never had thought of it as my topic or my issue. But simply looking and saying, oh, there aren't any. And what are we going to do about that? And so I gathered up the women that we did have and asked them that same question is what are some things that we can do to overcome the issues that we have here? One of the centerpiece items was mentoring. And so the two things that we decided to spend time on were mentoring and outreach. The whole time we've been in existence as a group, we've kind of underlined that the main point is to do a good job of our day jobs. And so all of us have to be good at what we do for a living. And so with that being the table stakes, if we have extra time, what do we want to spend it on? Highlighted that recruiting and mentoring were both worth our while. So mentoring is interesting. I think there's sometimes been a feeling maybe amongst people and certainly amongst generations in our industry that like women can mentor each other and we can pull ourselves along by our own bootstraps. And I think there are outstanding women and we have to keep forming a community. But it's also true that fabulous men are a significant piece of our mentoring program. So we started one to sort of say, let's find people who can help you develop in your career. And many of those people are men, just because to point A, there's not as many women leaders and we need to have leaders mentoring people that want to come along. So mentorship is one of the ones that I'm not going to say it's easy to do, but it's super important to do. A related piece is thinking about what is the community that we can build among the women who are here so that they feel not isolated, going to that point of feeling like you belong. And so, for instance, in our case, we have a couple of things. One is a quarterly meeting for women in operations. For instance, we're getting together for lunch for Women in Construction Week, and we'll have some talks and introduce the new women that have joined us since last time and talk about that. We do volunteer projects together. There's a thing called Women Build, where we're going to go build Habitat for Humanity House sometime this month, since it's the Women's Month. And so do a few things like that, where we build community among the women that are here. And part of it is being intentional on job assignments. It's interesting how we're similar to other construction companies in that we have about 1% women on crews. So not very many women are on crews. It might be growing. California Department of Industrial Relations says that there's about 4% women in apprentice programs. And so we might be getting more. But both of those numbers are truly pathetic. So if you look at the numbers that we have on crews, three of the women that we have are on the same crew. And that's pretty interesting. So it turns out there's two sisters and a cousin. And so they joined up partly because they felt comfortable. They're like, okay, this is an okay place. I can talk about the things that I'm seeing as challenges and share my experiences and feel like I'm going to be treated well. I like to say that there's more and more awareness, even in construction field operations, which isn't historically identical to like a retail or banking environment. There's more and more awareness of kind of treating women respectfully and all the things that that means. I think we've overcome all the basic hurdles, but there's still little things that are hard for people who aren't paying attention. But if you've got three women on a crew, that's probably not going to be a thing. And so trying to figure out how do we do staffing and assignments so that women have colleagues as well as resources to continue exploring their own experiences and figuring out what are the things that are going to be barriers for them and is it for everybody else or just for them is a deal. There was a woman early in my management career who had reached out for a mentor and she worked in a different part of the state. So I traveled down to meet her for breakfast and she was a project engineer and had wanted to talk about the fact that she felt like the foreman wasn't doing what she said or following her direction because of her gender. And I said, well, actually, it's probably because you're 22 and he thinks he knows more than you. And he probably does. And if you talk to the other men that are your same class, I bet they have the exact same experience. And it was just a relief for her, because that's the thing, is you don't know if your experiences are normal or not. So saying, no, that's actually normal for a brand new PE not to have total direction of the foreman, you might want to consider. So I think just being able to compare notes, going to your point on what's the low-hanging fruit, is important. And the other thing companies can do is to think about what are ways that we can create community and allow for things or that make women feel more comfortable being part of things. So I've done some allyship conversations, both at work and in some industry settings, to talk about all the little things that comprise that. So for instance, literally making room at the table. So if you've got a meeting and it doesn't have enough chairs, making sure the women actually have somewhere to sit. So you don't walk into a room and find that you have to be standing or going to find your own seat. Or if you're standing in the hallway talking and there's a clump of people, kind of opening the circle for a woman to join you. So there's some little things like that, which are just basic physical gestures that indicate I'm expecting you and you're a normal part of this group. And that just, it's really interesting how far that kind of thing goes to make women feel like they belong. There's asking opinions. And so it's one of those things where I hesitate to say that this is all about women, because there's also factors like seniority and other topics, but there's a lot of women who don't necessarily speak up right away or maybe volunteer their opinions as readily as some of their male counterparts. And so just listening and making sure that you've asked people's opinions in the room who may not have shared them or called on folks, that sort of thing, I think increases the amount of participation that women have in the workplace and the way that folks feel comfortable being part of meetings and part of conversations that are super important for how this all works.
You covered a whole lot and there's a lot to unpack there. I love the image of you're a guest in this home versus this is your home. That really brings it into focus as to what you want folks to feel like. You talked about allyship and one of Tykert's initiatives around mentorship, which started some time ago. I know when we spoke before, Mary, we talked about the difference between mentorship and sponsorship, and I was wondering if you could say more about that from your perspective.
Sure. So I'd say mentorship, which many of us have kind of been part of maybe our whole careers, is someone who would be a regular part of your career and give you advice on how you proceed and suggestions on your own ambitions and your own challenges and how you overcome them. There's formal programs like the one we've tried to set up, and then informal relationships that people form at work, where it's someone you can go to for advice that helps you navigate your own career. And that's super important. And I think the informal ones are vital. And frankly, if everyone could form informal mentorships with people that they really resonate with, I think that would be ideal. In our case, we match people up to try to foster and facilitate that. Sponsorship is a little different. And sponsorship, I kind of picture as talking about people in a good way behind closed doors. So it's saying that here's someone that I feel like deserves the next opportunity, or here's someone that I'm going to advance and suggest for promotions and advancement and maybe new job assignments. So, and it doesn't have as much of a time component. Like mentoring has a ton to do with directly developing a person. And sponsorship has a little bit, and obviously someone could do both these things, but sponsorship is advocacy and saying that here is a top-notch candidate for this next thing. So one of the things that I think about sometimes is, you know, we have a few women that are outstanding contributors that are in part-time capacities because they're also taking care of their kids. And so for me, part of it is the folks who are their sponsors also are always highlighting their contribution and their ability to take on the next assignment. So if a job comes up and someone kind of probably unconsciously dismisses them because they're part-time, the folks who are really advocating for them and saying they're super capable, they're going to make it work, this is something that we should give that person an opportunity to do, that's an example of sponsorship where you're actually saying, I'm looking out for that person. So the thing that's really cool about it, well, two things. One is the fact of noticing someone's capabilities, because I think one of the historical challenges probably for all of us as human beings is that we maybe support or notice the contributions of people who are more like us. So it may be easier to see someone's contributions that you can recognize as your own. So having people, and often this is men, just because going back to the demographics of our business, be able to say, hey, this woman's contributing in a huge way, and I think we should give her this next assignment, is really cool sponsorship. And sometimes take some conscious effort going to that point of it may not be a person that looks like you, or in the case of part-time, it may not be a person whose contributions look exactly like they have for throughout the history of the industry. But noticing talent and noticing capability and energy and ability to contribute is what leads to having an outstanding kind of sponsorship outcome.
That's great. Just to continue on that theme, you know, what else could male leaders do? I guess leaders in general, but those that happen to be male, what else could they do to really bring more focus to this issue?
Well, that's a great question. And I think there's a few places that have to do with looking through your organization or your industry to see where the roadblocks are. So for us, two centerpiece ones are finding and recruiting women, and then also developing them through the ranks. So if you look at finding and recruiting women, part of it has to do with having this be a conscious goal and trying to figure out what are the pipelines that we have and are we being conscious about who's in them? One of the advisors that we've talked to in the course of our journey here had a suggestion that you have your final applicant or your final candidate pool resemble your initial applicant pool. If you had a couple of women in the initial applicant pool, you should have a couple of women that you're finally considering for a position. So don't screen them out at the first opportunity. So there's a piece about recruiting where I think everyone who's a leader has a chance to make sure that they're being conscious about demographics. And this doesn't have to do with compromising standards. I think none of us is going to get anywhere with compromising standards. And it's not good for women, because I think there's so many incredible, smart, talented women. None of us want there to be compromises. But it does have to do with having a broader net of looking at capability and saying that these people have capabilities, even if I don't see them looking the same exact way I did. So part of it is with recruiting. And it's not simple because, you know, there's not as many women in the pipeline, frankly, to be honest. I talked about apprenticeships having about 4% women. We also, at Tykert, we recruit a lot of folks out of college settings to be project engineers, as do many of our peer companies. And so there was one year that we hired all the women in the Chico State graduating construction management class, but there was only four of them. So there's just also an issue with trying to find them and say that's part of it. So I think the first thing is being conscious that this is one of the topics that we're looking for and being part of the outreach effort. And then as far as development goes, that sponsorship topic is a big deal. And so saying that it matters to me to advance the women that I have and to notice what their specific issues and topics are. So we have some incredibly fabulous project engineers and assistant project managers and increasingly project managers who are women. And so I'm mentioning those roles because they tend to be closer to the earlier stages of their careers. At my company and in my industry, there's just not as many women at senior levels. And so where does the gap happen? And some of the gaps are super thorny, kind of like society and human being structural issues, like women more commonly take off to raise kids. And so what are we going to do about that? Like, that's not really a company topic, but it is something about a structural organizational topic. I mentioned briefly, how do we figure out part-time and figure out what are ways to have women stay engaged in the workplace, even if they're going into that type of setting? We've kind of experimented a little bit at Tykert with things like, can we also offer like emergency daycare? So for instance, if a woman has a meeting that runs long or has an obligation for client stuff in the evening, is there some way that we can support childcare? Because that's one of the things where if they have to suddenly leave and go pick up their kid at daycare, they're not part of the same conversation and they don't have the same experiences as if you can actually stay and finish the whole conversation or have the entire involvement with a customer. So there's places where that's worked, you know, like specific people where we say, here's part of what we want to do is pay for your babysitter. And so turn in your expense report. We'll put this on there. We want you to go do these things. And the one that didn't work as well is when we tried to actually come up with a childcare firm ourselves. We're very spread out, as many construction companies are. So just the logistics of that didn't work. But it has occasionally been beneficial to say, hey, we know that this is a reason that you're not able to stay and participate, and we're willing to pay for the difference. And so it's obviously case by case, because I don't know how we could universally do that. Everybody has situations at home to navigate on their own. But being able to make it possible for people that we feel like we want to sponsor and we want to mentor and we want to bring them forward, and saying, we're going to talk about things like how you take care of your kids. You know, and there's plenty of industries and companies where I think they're not as discussed. And sometimes I've worked for a company before where basically having pictures of your family on your desk made it seem like maybe you weren't that committed. So having the sense that actually we do care about what's going on with your family and your personal life, and we're going to do our best to make that possible, I think is half the battle. Because having women not feel like they're on their own and they're supposed to figure this out by themselves, I think has been a really great message when we've communicated that. So that's one thing, is identifying specific challenges. And then the last part is to not assume anything, like assume that women are capable and then stop assuming, was a quote that I really liked. So don't assume that they don't want to travel. Don't assume that they don't want to work late. Don't assume that they're not going to be able to participate. There's a lot of ways in which I think really super well-meaning assumptions also get in the way of women developing, because people think they're taking care. And part of what they're also doing is not offering women the same opportunities because they don't think they'll be able to take them. So one of the things that I sometimes like to highlight is that's not really a reason why women don't advance, is because they don't want to travel, or they don't want to get dirty, or they don't want to mess up their hair with a hard hat. Like, those aren't real things. So I'm sure there's women like that. And there's probably men like that. Like, some people don't want to travel and get dirty or get up early. But assuming that that's the case with women is just not correct. And so saying the women that we want love that stuff. You know, the women that we want all the same things as the men that we want, which is to really be part of the business that we have and to make the trade-offs that are required that we all make because we think the work is exciting.
I'm curious, Mary, what haven't we talked about as it relates to this issue that would help bring more focus to it?
I'd say there's a couple of basic messages that I keep always thinking that I want men to also think. One is that it's to all of our benefit to have more women be here. And the centerpiece reason for that is that there's a lot of talented women and we all love talent. I've often quoted Warren Buffett, who said that part of the reason for his success is he only had to compete with half the population. And so thinking about how powerful our industry would be if the whole population wanted to be here, that's a significant talent pool that we all need talent and we all need fabulous people. We talked at the beginning about the workforce shortage and about the aging workforce. And frankly, just for us to continue getting smarter and better as companies, we need all the talent we can get. So thinking of it as a women's issue is a little bit short-sighted and self-limiting. And so I continue to think that part of it is thinking of it as an industry issue that we're missing out on talent and how are we going to go after it, I think also reframes that topic. You know, I've been on boards or on settings before where if I'm the only woman, people ask me, what are we going to do to get more women here? And I've commonly said, you know, all of us know women. You all know women. What do you think? Who should we be asking to join this organization? So thinking of it as a company issue or an industry issue instead of a women's issue, I think is critical. And it's not even hard to do. Even if you're not so inclined from a philosophy standpoint, you can just look at the numbers and see that there's a bunch of talent we're not tapping into. So a centerpiece item is it's everybody's topic. A second topic is to make sure that we're feeling like women have a seat at the table and that they're part of the team. And from there, just continuing to have women do an excellent job, give people performance reviews, help them really get developmental feedback, understand what are the things that they need to be doing better. Because that's the other side too, is that good women, we don't want people to pull any punches either. I always want to know, what do I need to work on? Just the same way as I think my excellent male colleagues always want to know, what do they need to work on so that we can get better and continue advancing our careers and our ability to contribute. So all those things, like treat women the same way you would treat amazingly contributing men, I think is really a key. And I think an opportunity in a lot of places.
You know, it's as you talk about Warren Buffett, first thing that came to mind was his business partner, Charlie Munger, was always famous for mental models. And he talked a lot about the power of inversion. So if you think about the problem in reverse, usually you'll get farther. The punchline he always used is, you know, I want to know where I'm going to die, so I never go there. Or if you want to be more innovative as a company, just stop doing all the things that stifle innovation. Don't necessarily come up with a 27-point plan on how to become more innovative. And so if you apply that same philosophy to this issue, there's lots of new initiatives that companies could take up to increase diversity, to attract more women to operations roles. But a good bit of it could just be as simple as, what are the things you're doing today that basically cause that to not happen?
So some of the things that men who are interested in this topic can really do, tactically speaking, is to take women with you. And so having a chance to go visit job sites or to go to customer meetings or to visit vendors or check out our mobile equipment, things that are outside and really in the nuts and bolts of what we do, are great opportunities for anyone. And so grabbing a woman that you think might actually be able to continue to develop and just taking her with you as a shadow, I think is super important and key. It also helps women start thinking about things they might want to do. It was beneficial to me earlier in my career when people would even just take me to capital planning meetings and say, hey, we have a thing today. We're going to decide what we want to add to the fleet. You want to come? And it doesn't like I have a role. It's more of a fly on the wall question. But exposing women to all the things that go on in our industry is an opportunity that men can do who have that chance. One thing is to ask women what the experience is like for them. So I've had some super lovely conversations with men in the course of my career, just because they were also open and straightforward about they weren't really sure how to work with women. one of my roles along the way was aggregate sales, where I was selling rock to construction customers. And one of my customers, after I'd been working with him for a month or two, finally just opened up and said, "I really don't know how to work with you." And really, you know, when my old salesperson gave me a price increase, I could just give him a noogie and flip him off. And I figured, I can't do those things with you. And I don't really know how to treat you. So just being able to have an open and direct conversation about the elephant in the room that I don't know how to work with you was great for me, because there's a super high level of trust that goes with vulnerability and saying that I don't really know what I'm supposed to do right now, but I'm interested in being better at it. That's a great conversation. And so men asking the women that you respect and have some interest in developing what it's like for them and what is it that you can do that will make this more comfortable for them, I think is super important. And then finally, there's just don't be afraid to make mistakes. So I talked about assumptions and how trying to not assume that women are not going to want to travel or not going to want to get dirty. It's also the case that sometimes people are going to mess up and sometimes people are going to do those things and say, "Okay, well, I thought this would be a good thing for you and it turns out it wasn't," or "I thought I was helping and I'm not." And that's okay. Try again. And people sometimes they goof up, or I don't even know if I can hear it anymore when people say things like "sweetie" or "babe" or whatever. I don't even know if I register that. But keep moving, you know, get better, keep moving, get better, make mistakes and try again. I think people that are afraid of making mistakes and afraid of they're going to say the wrong thing, and so therefore they steer clear of women and try not to talk to them because they're afraid they're going to goof up, that's a worse error than saying, "Yeah, I might, but it's okay. We're going to get in here and figure it out together," is super key. So I think getting in there and figuring it out and trying to do the best each time and a little better than last time is the super is a super way for men to continue advancing the cause of women in all their companies.
Yeah, there's two things that, as you were sharing, Mary, kind of struck me that we've talked about internally at FMI with respect to recruiting and retention. From a recruiting standpoint, you know, this theme of you can't be what you can't see. If a candidate is looking at your website and they look at all the photos you have of your people and they don't see themselves in that snapshot, they're probably going to keep shopping. And so everybody has to start somewhere, but you can't be what you can't see. And so if they are not reflected in the image that they see back, then they're probably going to keep going. And so you have to demonstrate to the marketplace how committed you are to it. And then the other is just this concept of recruit the ones that are already here. And so once somebody decides to vote with their feet and join your company to become part of your team, the recruiting process doesn't stop. You know, it's really just getting started. So how do you continue to invest in that individual so that they don't get happy feet, take that next recruiter phone call and decide they may want to go somewhere else? And so those are two things that we talk about that I think very reflective of what you just shared.
Well, there's a piece about recruiting the ones that are already here that's super interesting and goes back to some of those subtle things we were talking about with allyship. So making people feel like they want to be here and they can advance goes a little bit to the assumptions point, you know, that assume that the ones that are already here actually want to stay here. And what are the investments that you would make in them? I feel like I've also been in conversations where people feel like women are going to leave anyway, and especially that these more junior women who haven't had kids yet are not likely to stay. So not making those kind of assumptions and thinking they may stay and they may be amazing. So what training and development opportunities are we going to send them to? And it's also true that people may do all those things and then they might leave. That might happen. And that also might happen with men. So going ahead and making all the investments and sending people to their training programs and going off and doing their 360s and their experiences and their offsites, all those things are things that help women that are already here feel like they're part of it. And frankly, the good ones actually develop, which is also exciting.
That's great. You know, I don't know why Charlie Munger's on the brain today, but he talks about errors of commission and errors of omission. You know, the commissions are the easy ones, right? You know, you do something, you screw up, you can kind of recognize in the moment, "Hey, I screwed that up." Errors of omission are the things that you don't do that you should have done that usually are only visible in hindsight. And so, you know, when you mess up or you actually just don't try, you know, that's an error of omission, right? Because you're not allowing women to thrive in the workplace if you're not willing to work with them or give it a shot just because you might make a mistake.
I think the errors of omission are interesting because I think men who are uncomfortable and aren't sure if women are going to say yes or if it's going to work out would tend to not do things like bring them on a ride around or to a job site or to maybe to a meeting that they don't necessarily have to go to. So thinking that I'm going to actually go ahead and try, this is a good way to overcome the omission piece, move into commission of let me try. And they might say no, and it might not work out, but we're all going to try to make mistakes and try again. And I think a centerpiece is that there's a lot of people of goodwill trying to solve these problems together. And so part of it is let's all work on this together, because everybody's not perfect and it's not always going to work out. But if you can see people's intentions are good, you can also give each other feedback. I had an experience early in my career when I was a project engineer of being in a field operations meeting where our super well-meaning safety specialist, who was a lovely, warm person and had been with us for probably 40 years, was announcing this law that had taken place where if you have more than 5 people on your crew and one of them's a woman, that you have to have a second blue hut, so a second porta potty. And his conclusion was, so be sure if you have 5 people that none of them's a woman. I'm like, hey, hold on. That's not the right answer. He's like, what? What did I say? He was completely floored as to what the problem had been. And so the funny part to him, it was funny to me because I'm like, he didn't realize what he had just said. It's a little frustrating. It would be nice if that isn't how it came up. But the great part was that we're both people of goodwill and we're going to sit down and hammer it through. And he could come to realize, I see what I said and that's not my intention. And let me try this again. And I could sort of realize where he was coming from, which is that he has a huge heart and he's trying to be a problem solver and not realizing in that moment, here's the impact of what you just said. So keeping your sense of humor and working on it together with people where you both care about each other and care about the outcome and might not say everything right all the time and might not really have the right instincts in that moment all the time, but we're going to take a look at it and fix it for the next time, I think is a centerpiece to all of us solving the problem together. So I personally feel as though one of the ways that I have made my career and how it's worked out is by essentially that I love what I do. I really enjoy my colleagues and I figure it out when there's a lot of stuff where I'm the only woman. And so it doesn't bother me and I'm not kind of carrying a torch. But it's also true that someday we need to have this be a workplace where you don't really have to have a super great backbone and thick skin to do it. You know, like what was it like being the only woman on hunting trips or the only woman on golf trips or the only woman that's, you know, going to this offsite or whatever? Like it's something where I just kind of shake it off and keep moving because, again, the point is these awesome people and the work that I'm doing, but it's not always super comfortable. You know, I sometimes talk about how I remember this moment of realizing that what I wear is what women wear. And so I'm going to quit fussing about the fact that I don't want to wear Carhartts and the stuff the guys are wearing isn't really my thing. Okay, so I'm going to wear something else. And then that's what women are wearing because I'm the only one. And it's not ideal, but it's sort of one of those, for me, to your point on mental models, I'm going to have to go ahead and not worry about these things. But it's not simple because what are the things that you have to quit doing? One is having settings where all the people in it that are comfortable are people that have always been comfortable in that setting. What else are we going to do? And one thing I've really appreciated, my staff is completely awesome. And as you might imagine, this is a thought-provoking topic for the men as well as women that work for me. But one of them pointed out that not even men like doing all that stuff. He's like, if you look at all the men in the group, they don't all like hunting and they don't all like golfing. So it is incumbent upon us as an industry to think of other ways to spend time together and build relationships. So there's a few things to think about from a reverse standpoint, I suppose. Because I think that there's a lot of opportunity to draw people in from more diverse backgrounds if we don't all do the same things the same way we always did them.
You know, and something I've heard you talk about before is just things like the company swag store. Are there choices for both men and women? Do they fit men and women? Those sorts of things. Same thing with hard hats, equipment, PPE.
Well, it's funny because there is a safety topic that people sometimes raise related to PPE. So do you have small enough gloves and do you have the right size of safety glasses? So those kinds of things can certainly be actual topics. And then there's just the belonging piece that does go with how many times have I just had to have at one of the company golf events, just the men's small polo. Well, okay, that's fine. And also it's not anything I'm going to wear outside of today.
Right. Right.
Because that's not actually what I wear. It's men's clothes. So there's a little bit of that, which I think can super underline where women are welcome. So one of my colleagues and one of the other board members on the Beavers, Dina Kimball, runs an electric company where they actually made a super conscious effort to get fabulous women's swag and went out to look at, you know, what kind of vendors create really cool items for women, you know, golf wear or jackets or the Kuyu kinds of things, like really neat stuff that we always have that are often men's sizes, and really gotten great creative things for women. And I think that sort of thing just underlines the basic message, the subtle points of we do want women here. And that's one that you can do consciously. I think there's some unconscious stuff where if we notice it, we can get over it. And one of those examples would be mistaking women for someone more junior. So I kind of have gotten to where I just think it's funny if people ask me to get coffee or if they start addressing the man I happen to be standing near as though he's the person in charge, because I just wait for them to realize their mistake. And I think that's kind of comical. But this goes back to, like, I shouldn't really have to. And we should be able to have women who don't have that experience that are like the same as men, recognized for whatever their job actually is. Like, you're the project manager, so maybe someone shouldn't be addressing the laborer standing near you as though they're the one running the program. So there's little things like that. But I think they're more unconscious, and it takes a lot more work to realize that you're doing that and to quit doing it than it does to go out and make sure that you've got women's swag as well. But there's a lot of little ways that I think men that are committed to this and creative about it can think about, what are ways that I can assume that the women here are awesome contributing members? And let's start with that, and not that they're necessarily in a support role. And the thing that's tough for me right there is that there's a lot of amazing women in support roles. So I don't mean to be dismissive and say that that's not a good thing, or that the women that are doing it aren't contributing a lot, because they are. But I don't want to be mistaken for a secretary because I run this company. And so having people say things like, can you make the copies? I'm like, no, I'll go call somebody. So there's just little pieces, which again is another place that women can help underline it by politely declining to do things that are not part of their actual job role at the moment. So there's a lot of little subtleties like that that I think we've got a long way to go.
That's great. Back to the theme of this is your home versus you're a guest in this home.
Mm-hmm. And you belong here in the seat that you have.
Well, Mary, this has been a great conversation. I can't thank you enough for taking the time to do this and for getting up so early to do this out in California. Maybe would like to end with the question of just, what advice would you go back and give your early career self?
If I were going back and giving my early career self some advice, I think part of it would be, don't take yourself too seriously. Like, have some good self-respect, but don't get too wrapped around the axle. I think the most important things that happen in our industry is that we do outstanding work. We're paid well. I'd say one thing that's terrific about our industry is that women are paid about 93% of what men are paid. And nationally, that's about 83%. So women in construction make more money relative to men than almost any other industry there is. So women are paid well in this line of work. So saying we do outstanding work and we get paid well and we have the opportunity to do incredible stuff. And so, you know, some of these things really need to be tackled, but they're also not the end of the world. So let's figure it out. And let's find people that share that same attitude and focus on the things that are super important and let the little things go. So I think I'd probably do that. And then two is that my career has benefited immensely from having great mentors. And so I'm lucky to work for my uncle, who cares a ton about me personally, as well as my career. And also before that, even when I didn't work at a family business, finding people who supported my career and who thought highly of my capabilities was something that really made not only my work life more fun, but also helped me understand what are opportunities I should take and where's places that I should raise my hand. Because I think probably all young people, and particularly young women, don't always think of raising their hand and saying, hey, I'd like to do this and I'd like to take that next thing on. And having a mentor or advisor that will do that for you is something that I think everyone should seek out. And I feel super lucky to have had them. So I'd say not take yourself too seriously and find people who support you in your career and take their advice.
That's great. That's probably a great place to end the conversation, Mary. Again, thank you so much for doing this. Always great to see you and really appreciate it.
Thank you, Scott.
As always, thank you for listening, and please don't forget to like or subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss another episode.